salutations. This is volume 3 of In Between Days. I'm Ryan McNeil, and you can find me on thematinee.ca. Handy little gizmo, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
My guests are amused by the iPhone. It's like
silent people. We don't do
sound. Yes, yeah, so everything here will be
silent.
We'll have inter cards for sure. I usually start with a trivia question, and I don't know if you guys will, you probably both know the answer to this.
No.
If you know the answer, just hang on to it because I'll actually give it.
If we don't
at the
know
end
the
of the
answer,
show.
You can edit it.
I'll
out.
Make one.
Well, so the theme of today's show is going to be silent films. For a reason which I'll explain in a second. And recently, of course, we had the Artist become the, when you adjust for inflation and whatnot, the number one silent film at the box office. But what's number two? Does either one of you know?
I guarantee you The Artist isn't number one at the box office.
Well, of course. Not by much, actually. Does either one of you know what number two is?
Well, you know what? That's a bit of a question, because for years it was thought that... taking into consideration inflation, Birth of Nation would be number one.
Well, and are we talking about original releases only, or are we including
no.
re-releases over the
yep.
century? Yeah. That would have been my guess, but you're teasing, so I suggest you think you're...
I don't know.
I'm wrong. I don't know.
We will come back to it.
I hate it when the trivia answer is a racist movie, so I'm going to hope that it's not true.
I say it's... I don't know.
Okay.
Is there a prize if I win?
I'll pick up your tab. I'll buy your soda. How about that?
You get to be in the podcast.
Well, my guests today are Shirley Hughes and Chris Edwards. They are both from the Toronto Silent Film Festival. It's now in its third year. It is its third year. And correct me if I'm wrong, it is now Canada's only silent film festival?
Well, I hope it's not.
No, exactly. But
I hope actually there are other silent film festivals out there in Canada. As far as I know, we're still the only silent film festival in Canada. We're certainly the only silent film festival in Toronto.
But certainly the only standalone silent festival as opposed to classic films.
Yeah
that, that may include silent films.
Right.
I mean, that would be the distinction, I think.
Right. And it will be playing across this fair city from March 29th to April 3rd. And we thought we'd talk today a little bit about silent film, because it's not something that I cover too much on my site, but it's something that I've always had a curiosity about and interest in, as many people who meet you, I'm sure do. How did the festival get started? Which I know, I do apologize, because I know some of this is going to be the standard question.
I'll try not to give you the standard answer.
Oh, okay.
How did it all start? Well, how does anything really start when you do a project like this? It certainly doesn't blink in out of thin air. So it's from years of watching silent films, talking to other people which are interested in classic film in Toronto and around North America, and just sort of deciding, you know what, I think there is an audience out there for it. One of our main goals is to put forward film preservation and restoration, which is a huge issue for all films, not just silent films. Silent films are kind of like the poster child for film preservation, because close to 80% are lost. So we decided, yeah,
wow.
It's a huge, huge amount.
Yeah, it's brutal.
In fact, over 50% of films made before 1970 have been lost.
Wow.
So it's not just reserved for very old films, it's also newer films as well. So that was one of the things. We wanted to really showcase and highlight the incredible musical talent we have around Toronto for film accompaniment, because it's a very specialized talent musicians must have. We wanted to encourage others to go into film accompaniment. And quite honestly, silent films, there's a lot of really fantastic films out there. We wanted to show this was not a genre. This is the basis of all filmmaking right up until today.
So, but was there an aha moment? Was there like an evening such as this afternoon where you're
several
gathered on a table
of wine.
And somebody said, you know, you should do this.
No,
you should be the one.
Surely there was a bar involved somewhere.
There was a bar involved,
and it was like, okay, was there a Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney moment of, hey, gang, let's get together and do a silent film festival? Yeah, I could probably pinpoint it after half a bottle of bourbon. And, you know, not to be too glib about it, it was just one of those things that I just went, yep, let's just do it. Let's throw it out there. Let's see if people do want to have one in the future. Let's see how people respond to it. And we'll take it year for year. So after our first year, we got very good feedback and response from it. There's a lot of new people that came and saw films that have never seen silent films before. We had kids. We had kids from the age of 8 up to the age of 80. So we just went, got a lot of support from places like the Fox Theater and the Review, and the Toronto Theatre Organ Society up at Casa Loma, which we co-present with. So,
which has a functional...
fully functional, largest Wurlitzer Theatre organ in Canada.
You sit in that building and you feel it through the walls.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of funny, because that's the one I'm probably looking forward to the most. Probably not the least of the reason, because that was the only one I couldn't get set up with this press. but definitely looking forward to that. Just that building alone. Like, my interest in photography has had me wandering around that building taking photos.
It's a fantastic site. It's just a fantastic site to see a film in and to hear a film in. It's unbelievable.
And good for them for getting that organ and keeping it from ending up in a junk heap, because a Wurlitzer organ is something that it's very different from a piano.
It is
an instrument that can do a million things. It's remarkable, and we had the opportunity in one of the earlier festival screenings. I'm going to say it was Seven Chances, but mm-hmm. I'm not. Yeah, where was Clark Wilson?
Yes.
Yeah, he did a presentation. He was the organist, and there are very few people that can play these things. And he did a presentation for, I'm going to say, about 20 minutes beforehand, which was remarkable. The instrument can do anything. You wouldn't wonder where the sound had gone. You know, if you heard somebody use one of these things, because he can do anything. He can make a bee buzzing, a train arriving.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's great. It's really cool. And I don't think Wurlitzer's come through on DVD.
No, they don't.
You really have to see that.
The sound flattens out. You need the vibration. I mean, the theater organs were built in the late 20s to replace orchestras for silent films. Not all silent films just had a piano. A lot of, especially for opening, for premieres, they had sometimes 30, sometimes 60-piece orchestras playing their films. Obviously, even with the film going public back in those days, where you could have, theoretically, 10,000 people going through a theater per day to see that film. It wasn't uncommon. Shea's Hippodrome, which that theater organ originally was installed in, they would start showing films at 10 o'clock in the morning and do their last screening starting at 11. They would be lineups all day long. People went to see movies two or three times a week. Literally, you could have films playing two or three times, four or five times a day, depending on the length.
Yeah.
Starting in the morning and
going right through.
And those organists made fat money.
Oh, they're
Well, projectionists used to make fat money.
They made massive amounts of money. Huge. I mean, for really good organists, sometimes their name was above the title of the film on the marquee.
Really?
Sound ruined the economy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened.
Destroyed us.
Destroyed the economy.
This is why we're in the dire straits we are. We no longer have silent films.
That's right. Silent film, it's a little bit of a tough sell to the general populace for all sorts of reasons, which is unfortunate. I know, like, I've going a step further, like, I know people who I can't convince them to see a film in black and white. I know other people I can't convince them to see a film earlier than 1970.
Yep.
But what is it about silent films that speaks to you guys?
I'll let Chris start off with that.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I mean, I think for me, I'm somebody who's interested very much in images, in composition for things, and I couldn't pin down exactly what it was about silent film that really blew me away, but I mean, the way that I got into it was in my teens, and I remember the first film I saw, which was Metropolis, which is a film everybody that digs silent film has seen at least five times,
right?
Obviously. And I remember coming downstairs in my parents' house at 1 a.m. on a Saturday night, and I was about 15 years old, and just flipping channels, and I flipped over to the French channel just on my road through the dial, back when they had dials on TVs. And this thing came up, and it was a scene in Metropolis, if you know the film, where the city floods. It's the action high point of the film. And I'm watching this thing, and it's on the French channel, but it doesn't matter because it's silent. And I'm like, wow, this is just really odd, you know. Like, and I started watching it. I realized that in that environment, in the middle of the night, where it's just you and the screen, and you're in this sort of like mental cylinder with you on one end and the image on the other, nothing in between, no distractions. That you form a very intense, I'm going to say, personalized relationship with what you see. And I was like, I've got to find out more about this. And that sort of started me along, and that's what led me to do Silent Volume, which is my blog about these things a lot later on. But I'm sort of speaking to what prevents people from getting into it. I think it's sort of the thing that also gets them into it. I have an opinion that the difficulty that people have with silent film a lot of the time, it's partly that they don't know what they are, because they haven't seen them, so they think that there is no sound of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like, well, why would you want to watch that? That's like just like watching something with a broken speaker. Like, why would you want to do that? Not assuming that they accounted for that and built a type of an art form that made the most of that rather than making it a downside. But I think when you watch a silent film, you're seeing images that would potentially have sound if there was sound to have, as opposed to a modern film. Like, say, people always bring up the first half of WALL-E. They always do this and say, "Well, see, silent film still exists." But to me, that's false, because that film has no dialogue in the first half. I mean, that's what they mean by silent. It's not really what this stuff is. Images where people are talking and you hear nothing, or like something falls on the ground and makes no noise, and there's music played over that, and the music creates an emotional character that's not the same as a sound effect. So what you have to do in your brain is reconcile all of that together. You're knitting it together all the time, which is why they take concentration. I don't like to watch them tired.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's wise to do that, because it does take more intense concentration, more thought. But it's also, what it ends up doing is it allows you to create the film constantly in your mind. You see the image, you hear the music, but you reconcile them into one thing, and you're pumping a lot of your own experience and your own, just your own baggage, I guess, in the positive sense of that, into what you are seeing and hearing, and what you take away is yours. And that's why I think that a lot of people, if you don't get into a silent film, you don't get into it at all. Mm-hmm. But if you get into it deep, it just shakes you right down to the slats. Like, you walk away from it, and it's like a kid. And I don't mean to overemphasize the point, but I mean, I think that you really, it's yours in a way that nowadays, you have the definitive director's cut of somebody else's vision with the music exactly as somebody else intended it, and it's the same every time. And that's fine. That's great. I love sound film, too. You have to. But that's something that silent film doesn't offer you. Silent film offers you something else that I think is equally valuable, but it's your thing.
Now, I got to ask, have you ever tried, because one thing of the few that I have seen, I will admit, rather large ignorance here, because I could probably count the silent films I've seen on my fingers and my toes. But
10 is better than a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay, all right, I'm gonna feel better then.
For the record, I have not seen him barefoot, so I'm assuming that's 10.
It is 10.
Yeah.
Thank you. But the one thing I have tried with some of the ones I have seen is playing around with the music and thinking in my head of music that could work with it, and I basically just turn down the volume on the TV and put on whatever music I have in my head of this might work well with this.
Yep.
This might work well with this. Have you ever given that a shot and come up with some interesting results?
Music for silent films nowadays is getting a lot better. But early releases on VHS or DVD had horrible soundtracks attached to them on occasion, and still do. So in that case, yeah, I mean, you can, and especially if you have any level of musical knowledge. And it doesn't have to be classical music
or
a specific type. It could be, I've heard really good rock and roll scores done to silent film. Mm-hmm. It is. It becomes this personal attachment, and you do, as Chris said, really take something personally out of it because you put something into it as well.
Yeah.
It's very much a backward and forward thing with the film. And when you have live accompaniment, you add a dimension which cannot be duplicated anywhere else.
Right.
Every screening is different. And you will get accompanists saying, I can do this the same film three different nights and play it three different ways.
Huh.
And it depends on the emotional attachment they're feeling with the film at that time and what they want to explore. So you get this really interesting triangle between the audience, the film, and the musician, which really is. That's why we call it live cinema.
Yeah.
It is live. It's like a concert. It's like going to a movie. And people, if they see good silent film, and there's a lot of lousy silent film out there too, none that we show.
No, we wouldn't dream of that.
Wouldn't dream of that.
People, if you can get them into the theater, they come out and go, "Wow, I never thought it could be like that. That was incredible."
And I mean, I think there's stages that you go through as a fan to kind of get deeper. I mean, the old cliche, but it's true, is that the comedy ages the best.
Yes.
I mean, the thing nowadays, I have this running joke, I probably told it to Shirley, is that you talk to people, it's like, I don't watch silent film, but I love Buster Keaton. Yeah, I don't watch silent, you know, and it's true because his stuff feels the most modern right now, but the slapstick comedy, generally speaking, tends to work. And it was a piece I read recently, I think it was, I'm going to say it was in The New Yorker, where the author was arguing that the reason that the comedy ages best is because it's man versus world, not man versus man.
Yeah.
Because man versus man has a lot of like ethical issues involved that may have become old-fashioned by modern standards, or you know, the social mores that have fallen away. Whereas you're always late for work, you know, and you're always nearly run over by a car, and like all these other things, and that will always be the case.
I don't know about you though. I have never always been trying to stop a runaway train.
But Buster Keaton could actually just pull on the train and it would stop.
Exactly.
You know, which you can see, but I mean, like, that's...
That happens all the time, doesn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, with... Once you establish a base with the comedy and you start to get more into the earlier stuff, and again, I'm speaking as though silent film is only old. There is still, obviously, still films made, but they're rare. But once you get that base, that's when you get better at being able to pick up on the emotional cues, the physical miming, everything that's going on. Then you can get into the drama, and then some of that stuff will just punch you right in the stomach.
Hmm.
But, you know, start with the comedy. I always say start with Buster and then Charlie, and then work your way, you know, into the stuff that's more of the melodrama and go from there, and you can really get some great stuff.
Now, backing up a step, though, have you ever played around with the music for the films you've seen?
Yes and no. I remember when I was about, I don't know, 16 years old, I found a VHS tape of Phantom of the Opera. That would be the Lon Chaney version. And I thought, it had no sound on it, and I did not read that on the box, or the box didn't tell me that. I felt a little ripped off. So I thought, well, I have a DVD, or a CD rather, of the Toronto recording of Phantom of the Opera, like Andrew Lloyd Webber's. Well, I'll just play that over it. Well, that didn't work. But it was a good lesson, because I realized that it's not just enough to play random music over something, even if, in terms of tone, it's more or less in the same universe.
Right.
It's very important to have the sensitivity of the musician who is paying attention to the film, not trying to go into business for himself or herself at the film's expense,
right,
but actually to be there to bolster it. One of my pet peeves is people, musicians who, talented though they may be, approach silent film as though it's inherently weird, and then they play something weird over that. That bugs me, because they're not really paying attention to the content. They're paying attention to the form, and they're focusing on their inability to relate to it, and then they're turning that into your experience. which I think is unfair to the audience. I've also listened to Silent Film's Dead Silent occasionally.
It's going to be strange.
You know what?
The French like to do that.
The French are strange.
The French Cinematheque for many years decided that the only way they were going to screen silent films in Cinematheque in Paris was dead silent. Mm. You know what? The French.
I was going to say, like...
You love them?
It can work for you or it can work against you. I mean, I got a screener disc once from the TIFF Bell Lightbox, Toronto National Film Festival, Bell Lightbox, our festival theater here in Toronto, for The Unholy Three, which is a Lon Chaney film. And because that was going to get screened live with accompaniment, it had no sound.
Sounds, right.
So I'm playing this on my TV, and there's no sound. And it was in the middle of the day, and there was a baseball game going on outside my building. And so every once in a while, there'd be like this pop, and then there'd be like people going, yay, and all this stuff. And I won't say that it added to it, but just depending on the scene that was there, it was just, like I say, you reconcile things into the film, you know, and there were certainly scenes in that film that, like, for example, there's a kid drumming. I remember this drumming at a new drum that he gets under a Christmas tree, and I felt more pressure mentally to create a soundscape in my brain watching that because I was given nothing.
Right.
I wouldn't recommend that, generally speaking. I hate watching them soundless in a theater with people because then you hear all the gum wrappers and you hear people sniffing, you know, and shifting their bums around and everything. Mm-hmm. So that gets distracting. I don't mind doing it in my own home where I can control the ambient noise a little better. It has its place, but they were not meant to be screened that way.
No, they were always played with sound. Maybe in the very, very early days in the 1895, 1896, but
they wouldn't have been projected.
They would have
by that point, would they?
Yes, they would. They were projected. 1895 was the first public screening. Okay. Mayer Brothers in Paris.
So when was the in the box?
On the Nickelodeons. That was the Edison stuff.
Yeah.
So it's different. There's different things happening all at the same time. It was never a progression. There was several different
technologies.
Lumiere brothers, Edison, all that stuff, and it gets into a very convoluted legal situations back in those days.
Just to clarify for anyone who doesn't know, what we're talking about is that you can get lots of DVDs now of super, super, super old silent films, which is actually a sub-interest of mine.
Okay.
Yeah, it's my goal to alienate myself as much as possible from mainstream. So even within the silent film community, I have to go for the stuff they don't watch. So I watch stuff from like 1900 or older.
And that can be very, very interesting.
They can be really cool, and because they had no rules and absolutely nothing to live up to.
Right.
Because there was nothing there. But some of that stuff in its original form would have been not projected at all. Not all of it, anyway.
Most of it would have been. The Lumiere stuff would have been. But you got to remember, films back in those days weren't necessarily black and white.
No.
There was different coloring processes, tinting, toning, the Hanschigel process, which is basically a color stenciling frame by frame.
Right.
So there was an awful lot of different things, and sound was also part of early silent film. They were trying almost from day one to somehow put a synchronized sound somewhere with film. It was never successful. Up until the Jazz Singer. Jazz Singer certainly wasn't the first sound, and it wasn't even a sound film, it was a part sound film. It wasn't even close to being the first, it was just the first commercially successful. Yeah.
And that technology was really fragile.
And that technology used. which they used, which was sound on disc, was dumped very, I mean, there was two competing systems leading up to the sound age. One was sound on disc, which the Jazz Singer was, and there is the competing one, which eventually won out, which was sound on film. So there was parallel technologies being pursued.
The problem with sound on disc is that if something happens to the record player while the film's going, the film must stop.
Yeah.
Or it gets comical.
And it gets there was a very elaborate series of how to get it back into sync, which I've seen the lists for, and I'm telling you, I don't know how any screening happened, but they did. But back to silent film, you know, silent films were incredibly varied. In a lot of ways, silent film isn't a heck of a lot different than films made nowadays. The subject matters are very similar. There's about love, it's about hate, war, revenge, and grand adventure, and silent films did the best grand adventures of all time.
And a lot of them were dirtier, too, than what came after the Hays Code.
Quite erotic in certain circumstances. There's a lot of nudity in early silent films. So there was an awful lot which you see nowadays, and if you see enough silent film, and you see a lot of film made nowadays, you're just going... Yeah, the clothes are different. Yeah, you know.
Some of the clothes are back in, actually.
Some of the clothes are back
this year.
In.
Yeah, and, the 20s are a new fad again.
You're just going, well, this isn't really a heck of a lot different than some of the film matter which is out now.
Yeah.
There is major social issues being explored in silent film, anti-war films, pro-war films, political films. Films against, you know, the white slave trade, against child labor. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Racism is explored. All sorts of things. Women's rights.
Well, you made a point earlier, and it actually may have been before we started to record, where you were saying that silent film is not a genre.
No, it's not.
And I really like that point because I can remember way back in the day, you know, flipping through the TV guide that came with my newspaper, looking at the movies that were coming up, and it would be like movie title, comedy, 3 stars, you know, whatever you want, drama, 3 stars, romance, and then silent would be one of those as well.
That'd but
be
silent like, what?
Yeah, silent what? I mean, like, exactly. You know, there's silent comedies, dramas, romances, action films, you know, whatever you want. There are hardcore art house abstract films.
Very you know,
all
abstract.
Kinds of, there are films that would be
avant-garde.
Termed erotic, mm-hmm. certainly by that period, mm-hmm. you know, and probably still today. Yeah, it's really a misunderstanding. It's a form, not a genre.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, 2011 turned... somewhat unexpectedly into a big year for the awareness of silent film with two major commercial films, The Artist and Hugo. Has there been an impact on the interest of the festival?
In about 3 weeks. let's say I went out with a group of people 2 weeks ago to see The Artist for the second time, for them for the first time. And I was speaking to a few of them beforehand and shamelessly promoting the film festival at the very same time and asked them, like, what do you know about silent film? They were going to see The Artist because obviously it won Best Picture, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And they were trying to figure out what it was all about. And it was a mixture of people, younger people, middle-aged people, older people, and most of them had never seen a silent film. Some of them didn't know what a silent film was. They, as you said before, they didn't realize that silent film just meant no dialogue and you know, ordinary soundtrack. It didn't mean it was completely silent. So I said, well, I'm not going to give you any foreground for it. I says, I want your reaction afterwards, your honest reaction. If you loved it, hated it, what did you think of it?
As a film.
As a film. Mm-hmm. And The Artist is a really good film. I mean, I wouldn't say it was a good film just because it was a silent film.
No,
it was a good film.
Yes.
And I'm probably going to see it again.
Good.
For the third time.
There's talk that it may have a showing with a live accompaniment.
Yeah, I think that would be really interesting.
It'd be cool to do it.
It'd be very cool.
Especially with the controversy about that soundtrack. It would.
I noticed that Kim Novak is backtracking as fast as she can now. But you know what? Whatever.
Yeah.
She can say what she wants.
Well, did they enjoy it, the people that you went with?
Yes, they did. They just went, wow, you don't need dialogue. And I said, no, I mean, silent film is telling a story through imagery and through music helping that imagery along. You don't really need dialogue at all.
No.
But there's a lot of people out there, which is for the same reason why they don't see foreign films, because they don't, and there's people, I don't want to read subtitles, and even though there's not that many intertitles in The Artist, or in a lot of, well, most silent films don't have too many intertitles, some people just don't want to read.
And that's another myth, that every word spoken on screen is transcribed in the title. I mean, that would be insane.
Silent film geeks have a running gag when they see old films. They know which films had different dialogue than the intertitles.
Okay.
And some of it, especially if the two stars were maybe arguing a little bit on set. There's one famous scene where hero picks up the heroine and is carrying her off, and you can see her saying, "If you drop me, I will kill you." And so that's sort of little things you know when you get to know an awful lot of silent film fans. They can point out the little spots in films.
Well, plus also they swear. What Price Glory is the famous example.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, where it's a World War I drama. And Victor McLaughlin's character does most of the swearing in that.
As he did in his real life, too.
Yeah, he calls people an SOB constantly. And you don't even need to be able to read lips that well to get that, because he's just blatantly saying it right on camera. Just bust the audience out.
Right.
And Our Dancing Daughters is another great example of that, which will be at the Toronto Silent Film Festival this year, with one particular word which pops into mainstream discourse quite a bit, which is said very blatantly. It's the only time I've seen that said in a silent film, although you might have seen others. Yeah, so starts with S, ends with T.
Okay.
It before.
Okay. Yeah.
But maybe not the one you think, because there are two that...
Oh, okay, okay. So, I see.
Yeah, you have to come to the festival to find out.
Well,
you know?
I'm looking forward.
I'm trying to market here.
Aren't we all? Mm-hmm. Now, what about... Because the other one, of course, this year that really brought a lot of awareness. What are your thoughts on Hugo?
I really liked Hugo. I'm not a big fan of 3D films.
You saw it in 3D?
I saw it in 3D.
Can you not see it in 3D?
Especially now on Blu-ray, but they did have a 2D version.
Okay.
I saw it in 3D, and I have to say Scorsese used 3D, I thought, to very good effect in that film. And I quite liked it. I liked the story. I thought the actors were quite good. I loved the storyline. And, of course, all the references to... I mean, it was really... Film Basics 101.
Yes.
What he did, and Martin Scorsese is a huge supporter of film preservation.
Yeah, yeah.
Massive.
He's a real hero
supporter
in all of this.
This was his how to teach the film-going audience about early film without ramming it down their throats. And apparently, after that film came out, it was very successful financially. Flickr Alley, which is a DVD production distribution company in the United States, which distributes the Malaise box set of films.
Which I own.
Which you own as a loan. Oh, no, I'm getting a set.
Thank you.
Apparently they sold out.
Wow.
They had a run on it.
And good for them.
Definitely.
Now, in response to... To the artist, the UK, and there's no comparable stats for North America yet, but the UK has reported a 40% increase in rentals and downloading of silent film. Now, they may be the usual suspects, but it doesn't matter, because you've got to start somewhere, and it's about getting new people going, this is kind of cool.
You do, and I think that Hugo, realistically... I am an eternal cynic, and I don't think that silent film will make much of a comeback. But if any of them are going to do it, I think that Hugo will have more positive impact in getting new, younger viewers and, you know, sort of like on the fence people to give these films a try than the artist will, just because there is less of a risk for your dollar going in. It's Scorsese's a major name.
Yep.
You know you're not going to get crap when it's Scorsese on screen. Maybe you don't love everything, but it's
have you
always...
seen Cape Fear?
Yeah. I don't hate that film.
I don't hate it either.
It's not a bad film. It's not as good as the original.
No. I even kind of like The Color of Money. I'm a big fan.
But it's
a children's film, so there's that. And I'd also say that in terms of Georges Méliès's work, is a silent film... imagery goes, his stuff, at least A Trip to the Moon, never completely left the public consciousness.
No.
So there was, I think that might even tweak a few people subconsciously when they saw that. It's like, oh yeah, I know that dude. You know, I know that thing with the thing flying into the moon's eyeball and, you know, in this and that. So I think that Hugo has done a lot, and probably in the long term will be responsible for more.
Yeah.
Also notice that Hugo hasn't been subjected to the kind of
scorn.
Debate. Well, scorn might be too strong, but I mean, I think that with the artist, there's two camps that are forming between those who think that it's a strong silent film on its own or don't, and then the people that are like, they only want to judge it as a spoof or not.
Yeah.
It's kind of like...
What's your opinion? Both of you.
I don't think it's a spoof. I think that it draws upon elements, but I don't think that you would accuse a regular sound film of doing that, even though most great sound films usually do as well. I think that it's attempting to be its own thing.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
And that is debatable, but that's my opinion.
No, I don't see it as a spoof at all. It has, like I said, there are elements of different things in it, but in the long run, despite its very upbeat ending, it's a very downbeat film.
Yeah.
It's about the destruction of a man.
Yes, it is.
It's about, and through him, the destruction of an industry.
Yes.
So, I mean, it actually is an incredibly well-done film. The director is very smart, knows his film history, and treats it with an awful lot of respect. There's an awful lot of directors which will take bits and pieces from different eras and just sort of use that imagery to their own purposes. That's fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But it was very nice to see him treat it in such a respectful manner and use it for the purposes that it was originally intended for.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than just use the gloss version of it, he went into and understands how sound films interact with the audience. Like in the middle or beginning of the film, he's having that nightmare and suddenly...
Yeah.
There is that ambient sound. He puts the glass down.
Thunk.
I mean,
that
was not only incredibly clever and incredibly funny, because people laughed.
It got the first screening I saw that got applause.
It got applause. It got a laugh. But you sit there back in it and you're going, it's freaky. Suddenly it turns this into a surreal avant-garde film.
Yeah.
Right smack in the middle of it. Doesn't tell you about it and then takes you out of it again.
Yeah.
And you don't even know about it until you've walked out of theater and went...
And I have seen, I know you have seen, quote-unquote, partial talkies, films that popped up around 28, 29, 30, that had sequences of dialogue within silent, an overall silent film that had the same effect, where all of a sudden you're in a different mode, and then it goes silent again, and it's very weird.
Jazz Singer is the perfect example. Silent film, suddenly he's... does that song, and then you expect the song to end, and he's so... And he improvised.
Yeah.
The little thing, you ain't heard nothing yet.
Well, I'm
completely blew the actress that played his mother away. She didn't know what she was, what am I supposed to do now? And they just kept rolling with that.
I do want to add, as it regards Hasner Vicious, and I mean, he understood what the interaction was between the audience and the film, but he also he made that film the way a silent film was made,
mm-hmm.
which is really a crucial point. The first time that I saw it was during the Toronto International Film Festival, and we were lucky enough to have the director on site, mm-hmm. along with James Cromwell, who plays the butler, and Jean Valentin, but his English wasn't so good.
Were you at that showing at the Elgin?
No,
because
I
the
saw
one
it
thing,
at the
one thing that was cool about that was that the opening where they're at the premiere,
mm-hmm.
there was this weird little echo effect because the theater that premiere happens in looks very much like the Elgin.
That's
oh, really?
Right.
So you're sitting in this theater watching this theater and just this neat little Russian dolls of a movie there. But please,
It was interesting because afterward, as is often the case with the festival films, you have an opportunity to ask the creators a few questions. And one question that was asked of them, what did you think about this production, you know, as an actor? And Cromwell's, you know, he's getting up there, he's around. And he said it was one of the most pleasurable film experiences he'd ever had on a set, because what they did, and they did this all the time back in the day, but they don't now, is that they played music while they performed.
Okay.
So that is to say, people in the background would, like, play a violin or whatever. And it allowed them to have more of an emotional expression in their work. And this was common at the time because you could do it because you didn't have to record anything for sound over that. So, I mean, kudos to him for going that extra mile. And I think it does come through,
Oh yeah.
You know, that he did that.
So
if somebody, like, obviously you guys both know your chops when it comes to silent film. If somebody was to listen to this or to go to your festival or to come away from The Artist or Hugo and think to themselves, I want to get into silent film a little bit more. This is really interesting. This really piques my curiosity. What's the gateway drug? What's the entry point that somebody could watch and it'll give them the broad strokes, it's accessible, it will move them along. It could be something that you each saw that got you into silent film when you first did. But
I can totally answer that right off the bat.
Well, go for it.
Please do. I gotta think of this.
The Buster Keaton, the Buster Keaton shorts. That's really the first place, because issue one is how long can you watch something that's in the silent form.
Okay.
Eventually, you'll be able to watch them for 3 hours, but at the start, you can watch them for 15 or 20 minutes. So, and you want something that seems a bit like modern film, so you don't want to go super old. So I would say the Buster Keaton shorts, which he mostly did, I'm going to say between 1920 and 1923, most of the shorts.
Oh, yeah, because he got his own studio in 1920 when Arbuckle went into features.
Yeah, but he was still doing the shorts for a few years. And so that would be my recommendation. Kino International, I think, put them all out in Blu-ray. I've seen them so long ago, like I have the old set.
Yeah, yeah.
That would be step one, because those films are all around the 20-minute mark. They're great. The best of them are genius. They're very entertaining. They have a very fresh feel. That's where you start. Then you can move into his... I'm sort of repeating myself from earlier, but you can move into his features from there. The General, The Cameraman, which is late in his work, but I find to be a really good film. Lots of others, but The General is the best. Then you can move into other comics like Chaplin stuff. And then the real key is then where do you go from there for drama? And I'm going to throw something out that I wouldn't have said a year ago because I didn't know his work as well. I think that Frank Borzage is a great place to start for drama.
I like his work. I think it's incredibly beautiful. But I think you have to be a little bit into silent film
to get that far.
To really,
well, I
to
think
really
for any of the drama
far.
You have to be in. To
I really do.
Can you think of a drama where you could start?
A drama where you could start. That might be a little bit difficult. I'll have to think about that one for a little bit.
Well, probably D.W. Griffith and Mary Pickford are where you start, right?
No, I don't
think
so.
That's me being funny.
That's you being funny, but I'm not laughing.
Yeah.
I have to agree with Chris. The Keaton stuff is very accessible. There's a lot of decent prints out there for it.
Yeah.
Keaton, like all the good comedians back in those days, was an incredibly beautiful mover. And I think that's one of the things that really resonates, I think, with silent comedy, the good silent comedy, is that Chaplin, Lloyd, Keaton, and Charlie Chase, things like that, they were incredibly beautiful in their movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just the pratfalls. I mean, Keaton's very good at falling down extremely well.
Very few pies were thrown.
Very few pies were actually thrown in silent comedy days. You know, they were incredibly beautiful to watch moving, and especially if you realize it was all done in camera, all done in real time.
Yeah,
those are great. Chaplin is different, and I know there's camps nowadays. Chaplin versus Keaton, which I think is absolutely ridiculous.
They wouldn't have supported that.
No, because they were very good friends. They were all very good friends back in those days. They were not rivals at all. Chaplin was a comedian of a different stripe, and his work is incredible. But he didn't just do straight comedy like Keaton did. Chaplin did social films.
Yeah.
People forget that Chaplin, from day one, he may not even realize it until a little bit later on in his career, always did films with a social background. Harold Lloyd, I think Harold Lloyd is one of those incredibly modern, accessible ones. Harold Lloyd was the 1920s middle class guy on his way up. Chaplin was always the loner, down and out guy, trying to just survive that day. And Keaton was just sort of this guy which was there.
Right.
He was just there all the time. They're all three of them are good. I love Charlie Chase. I think his stuff is incredibly funny. He's starting to emerge a little bit more. as a comedian in modern times. I think his stuff is incredibly funny. He has an incredibly plastic face, so he's incredibly funny. But the comedies are good. As for dramas, that's a tough one, because I mean, what do you do? I mean, you can, well, I wouldn't say dramas, maybe start with something like Douglas Fairbanks, where incredibly beautiful physical movement, and it's the grand adventure. Douglas Fairbanks is the great big boy on the grand adventure on the planet. I mean, what he does in his films is so unbelievably beautiful and incredible. It's about wafer thin in terms of depth, but it doesn't need to be anything but that. And we showed The Black Pirate the first year, and we had teenage boys coming in to see this film. Now, I can guarantee you these guys had never seen a silent film before in their lives. And they were, like, clapping, hooting, hopping. They're going, this is... They came out of there going, that was so much fun. I'm going, okay, we got 16, 15-year-old boys coming in going, that was really fun. It's silent. Well, it wasn't black and white. It was two-strip Technicolor, but it's... All the cliches of pirate movies was in this film, and they realized that this is the guy who actually started it all. Everything you saw in Pirates of the Caribbean, Douglas Fairbanks did it first, without CGI.
I would throw one more name out there in terms, and this is a director rather than an actor, but Murnau stuff, I think, is intriguing to a lot
of
people.
I think.
Yeah, the German stuff, although I really like City Girl. That's one of his American films, but his stuff would drift more into what you might say proto-horror atmospheric stuff a lot of the time. It's pretty weird, but he was a director's director. He was one of the guys that was really, really pushing the technical limitations of the medium and what it could say. Some of his most interesting films are not that well known, but his big ones, Faust,
Sunrise.
Last Laugh, Nosferatu, are brilliant. The Last Laugh might be the pinnacle of what silent film can say.
Yeah.
Because I think there's one intertitle in that film, maybe two.
Yeah. One. Yeah.
It's
the beginning.
It's amazing, and his stuff. One of the reasons too that I think his stuff is accessible for first timers is because it intrigues you visually, and his films aren't super long. I don't think there's any 2.5-hour Murnau films out there.
No.
So I mean, if you've gotten past the comedies or if you do want to try to drama, I would go with his stuff and check it out. Everybody's seen at least part of Nosferatu. Mm-hmm. Usually in like the history of Dracula, and this is where it started. Before we got to glittery vampires, we had grasping, bald,
vulture-ish
vampires.
We had real vampires back in the silent days.
Yeah, we were actually scared of ours. We didn't want to go to bed with them.
Did you ever see Shadow of a Vampire?
Oh, that was a scream.
I don't like that film, but...
It's not a great film, but it's got some... It was a lot of
fun, and it was historically more than just a little inaccurate, but it doesn't matter. It was rollicking good fun, and
yes.
It was a good take on a legendary subject. I had a great time with that.
Well, there we go. If people can't get to Toronto and they do want to dig into silent film, that's I hope people were taking notes during this podcast, because we just threw a lot of titles and a lot of people at you. Now, if people are in Toronto and they do want to come out, where's the site? Where are we going? What's the information that people could find out more about the Silent Film Festival?
Well, it's the usual World Wide Web at TorontoSilentFilmFestival.com. We're also on Twitter at TO Silent Film. On Facebook as well. You can buy tickets at the door, or you can buy tickets in advance, which is always nice.
And Chris, what's your site? You mentioned it very briefly earlier. What's the site you write on? What do you write about?
My blog is Silent Volume. If you search Silent Volume, you will find it. It's a blog that I've run for over 3 years now. I watch silent film on my own, and I want more people to watch them with me. So I try at least once a week, and sometimes more often, to write what some people call reviews or essays or posts on a particular film that I watch. And I go into it. I don't do a summary. I I suppose I critique it. Would that be the way to put it?
I would say you critique it.
Yeah, yeah, and talk about the elements that I find are interesting in them. Mostly I want people to take away from that there is a lot there. This is an art form. There are some great films, and if you sit down and give them a try, you can pull an amazing amount from them. So, Silent Volume, check it out.
Very cool.
And I'm also on Twitter as Silent Volume, so it makes it easy.
I'll be following you when we're done here, I'm sure. Well, my site, as everybody knows, is thematinee.ca. The Matinee cast will be back next week, where we'll be talking not about silent film, we'll be talking about The Hunger Games. There's a shift in that tone for you.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Don't we all? The song you're hearing as we close out here is Hang It Up by the Ting Tings, and the answer to the trivia question, what was number two? You were actually correct. It is Birth of a Nation, and it's not number two by much. Like, if you're just going by the straight numbers, the artist has something like 12.5 million. Birth of a Nation has 12, which when you turn it into modern money, it's actually a hell of a lot more than what the artist
took. And Birth of a Nation didn't have Harvey Weinstein come over working.
No, it did not.
And has been not out of film screen around the world since 1915.
There you go. Well, for surely, Chris, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee.